88% of the workweek is spent communicating, typing, talking, and going back and forth on topics until everyone is on the same page. It's time for a change. It's time for Grammarly. Grammarly's AI ensures your team gets the point across the first time, eliminating misunderstandings and streamlining collaboration. It goes beyond basic grammar to help tailor writing to specific audiences. Whether that means adding an executive summary, fine-tuning tone, or cutting out jargon in just one click. 4 out of 5 professionals say Grammarly's AI boosts buy-in and moves work forward. It integrates seamlessly with over 500,000 apps and websites, is implemented in days, and is IT approved. Join over 70,000 teams and 30 million people who trust Grammarly to elevate their communication. Visit grammarly.com/enterprise to learn more. Grammarly. Enterprise ready AI.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Healing Trauma Podcast, a space for those who are healing from complex and developmental trauma. Introducing your host, Monique Coven, a certified trauma recovery coach, survivor, and thriver. The intent of the podcast is to provide helpful information with insight that can validate, encourage, and support you on your healing journey. You're going to hear stories from other survivors and trauma experts, featuring therapists, coaches, and practitioners. We will open up the conversation on effective trauma healing modalities, practices, and tools. If you are interested in trauma recovery coaching, as well as recommended books and healing resources, head over to www.thehealingtraumapodcast.com. And now, here is your host, Monique Coven.
The following episode contains conversations touching on suicide and references to other mental health issues that might act as triggers. Please continue at your own discretion. My guest today is Alexandra Wyman. Alexandra was plunged into grief when her husband died by suicide. The sudden loss of the love of her life left her reeling with unanswered questions. The aftermath of suicide leaves loved ones in a mess of emotions. She's written a book called The Suicide Club, and it shows a way forward through anger, blame, and judgment towards more acceptance and peace. We're going to be talking about different issues relating to this in our conversation. And now, onto the episode. Hi, Alexandra. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Yes, this is a topic that when I think about it, I feel a little bit of a anxiety pit in my stomach. And I don't think that that's uncommon, because I think that what you have experienced and what we're going to be talking about is a lot of people's worst nightmare. And so it's not an easy subject, but it's such an important one to talk about. So I so appreciate you being here and sharing your story with us. And so let me start by saying you wrote a book called The Suicide Club, What to Do When Someone You Love Chooses Death. And this is your story, your husband's story. And I mean, I guess I'll just start with, maybe you can share a little bit of your background and then why you felt like you wanted to write this book and share this book with the world.
Absolutely. And again, thank you so much for having me on today. I'm really looking forward to our conversation. And you are right. This topic can create a lot of anxiety and nervousness on how to approach it. And I find that once we start talking or getting into it and having kind of seeing a different perspective than what is common, some of that anxiety tends to fall away. But my background, I moved around quite a bit as a child. I was technically born in California and then moved to Connecticut and then landed where I live now in Colorado. As I have talked about in the book, my dad is a Russian Orthodox priest, so we moved around for that. And I have two older siblings, so we all, after moving around, landed back here. And after college, I traveled quite a bit and decided when I came back to Colorado to get my master's in occupational therapy. So I do that and started working with children. And then in 2017 is when I met my husband, and we had just a whirlwind romance. I was a little older. I was in my 30s, so it wasn't like the, picturesque, you meet someone in your 20s right out of college kind of situation. But we just knew we had a soul connection. And so we were married in 2018, bought our house right after our wedding. And then we had our son in 2019. And then COVID kind of hit, right? As we all know, and got to experience that. And then in August of 2020, my husband died by suicide. And it was not any, there was no prediction to it. I didn't see it coming. It definitely put a little wrench into our picturesque life. I thought, man, I've checked all the boxes and now everything has been literally just ripped away from me. And at the time, I was gifted some beautiful journals, and some prayer books. But starting the night that my husband died, there was a lot of anger and blame that came out. And I find that that's quite common with a death by suicide. And I didn't have any space or time to really think through what was happening. I just knew that there were people who were asking questions, who were starting to whisper a little bit about wanting to take some legal action. And I thought, how do I walk through this? How do I get through this? And so I started looking up all different resources and didn't really find anything. And I decided I don't want someone to have to go through what I'm going through right now. And that's kind of what encouraged me to start writing, to give an opportunity, a tool, or a resource for other individuals. And I'd say some of the resources and tools in the book do can relate to anybody who has had a loss, not just by suicide. But really to say, you have to balance the business, you have to balance the emotional journey and grieving, and how do we do that? And so that was kind of the goal, to write a book that I wish existed when my husband died.
I think that because it's something that's so uncomfortable, we don't want to think about it. We probably don't have those kind of planning conversations, especially as young couples. You were not married very long. But I wanted to go back to what you said because I was curious. You said something about anger, and I just wanted to know, was this your own internal anger, let's say at what just happened at him? Or was it anger, people were angry at you, or was it like both?
Yeah, I think it was a combination. So, my husband had been with friends the night before he died, and then he went missing for a few hours. And so, for some reason, I just knew something was happening. And so, I started contacting everyone, and then with the whole result of the situation ending in his death. And so, initially, from that first night, as I've mentioned, I would say there was a lot of blame and anger towards me initially. Because people don't want to be necessarily angry at the person, right? There's anger for that person, like, why did you do this? Why couldn't I save you? Why didn't you pick up your phone? Why didn't I know this was coming? And then we can't really get those answers, right? That's a big part of suicide, is you don't get answers to the questions you have. And part of the process is being able to quiet those questions, and just, that's where I say some of the acceptance comes in. Just being able to accept you're not going to. And by the time we will see our loved one and be reunited with them, we may not even want to know what, you know, the answer to those questions. And so I think then a spouse is an easy target. Like, why didn't you know this was happening? Did you know this was happening? Did you do something that caused this? What part of your marriage played in this? And so that was, I've heard of lots of situations where family members, that's kind of the initial reaction, is that anger, blame, and judgment. Who's responsible for this? Who tipped this person from being okay with living to not being okay with living? And in reality, I don't know that there is any one thing. I personally don't believe that when individuals get to a point of contemplating suicide, that it's just one situation. Sometimes I think media or television will kind of sensationalize it, that there's this one big tipping point. I think it's just a culmination of factors, and then it gets to be too much. The individual is in so much pain that it looks like this is the one way, like this is how they're going to fix their pain. This is how they're going to fix what's going on for them.
Interesting that you say that, because that is something like I would have never thought of, but it makes so much sense that, you know, they're looking at the whys and the who to blame. And I just can't imagine, because as soon as this happens and you get the news and then that starts happening, I'm just sensing that there's no time to even process anything. It's just all coming at you.
In my particular situation, that is how it felt, that it was just one thing after another. I have known other situations that have not, where someone has died by suicide, where it hasn't been like that. So it's kind of hard, because it just depends on what is going on. But their reactions and the looking again for answers to those questions is very common. And then trying to wrap our heads, because it almost becomes like you've got, for me in my particular situation, here I am as the spouse and I'm just trying to understand grief, but I was in shock. But then you have the shock of everyone around you, and everyone's shock is going to dissipate differently. Their grieving journeys are going to start at different times in different ways, and people grieve differently, and there's all these, it's very complex. But then it's almost like you're trying to gauge off of each other. Well, here I am where I am in my grief. Where are you in your grief? Why aren't you doing this? Why aren't, you know? And so we're just looking for some normalcy or some security in our process, and it just gets complicated because it's just one thing after another. So I think it can definitely feel like that. There were moments where I just thought, oh my goodness, could I just catch a break of some sort? And I was grateful that I had support and family available to help me and to help with my son, so that I could try and compartmentalize and start to work through everything, not only that I needed to do, but to work through everything that was going on as well.
Yeah, I'm just listening to your story. And I mean, the listeners can't see, but as you're speaking, I'm taking breaths. And that's just listening to your story. But, you know, here you are, a young mom, and you have a son. So how old was your son at the time?
He was just over one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was also a very complicated matter, because I did know the first thing about single motherhood, what to do or how to manage. But yeah, it's been very interesting. I mean, I keep his dad alive for him, and he knows about his dad. And if I ask him, even now, he's 3 and a half now, and he'll say, well, daddy's in my heart. And I try, and there are people who have wonderful memories of his dad, and I'm so grateful to have that connection. But yes, he was just over one when this happened. And I can say that I was just starting to get my footing as being a new mom with a one-year-old. I was just starting to get that balance back. And then this happened.
Wow. So there's so many different questions, you know, I can ask you about, you know, strategies, which maybe we will get to, because I think they can be helpful for other people. I think what also could be helpful now, looking back, obviously not asking you at the time, but maybe you could share with us, do you think that there are anything or any identifying signs now that you look back? Because I think you said you did, this came as a surprise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I would say in my particular situation, there were things I knew about the struggles my husband had, and I knew that we were trying to find strategies and ways to get him help to not feel so stressed. However, I don't think that there, at least in my particular situation, and I can say that I have met quite a few people through support groups and just in general with the work I've been doing since he died, I haven't met anyone who said for sure that they saw signs. And again, we can see that our people are hurting. We can see that they're struggling, but there's nothing definitive to say, and the end result is going to be that you're going to take your life. And so that's really hard because we want that predictability. We want to create a sense of space or security that something like this that's so tragic won't happen to us. We want to know that the people we love aren't going to be in that kind of pain. And the reality is, I'm not sure that there is any way to predict that because you can take two people who have very similar experiences, may have this be dealing with this similar pain, and they won't have the same outcome. And so it's hard to predict that. But yes, it was a shock to everybody. And my husband was considered, the charismatic. This is what I also say. Suicide doesn't discriminate. I think sometimes we like to think of someone who's highly depressed, can't function throughout their life, making threats about taking their life or not finding the will to live. My husband was a very successful, like he had a successful career. He was very charismatic. He would light up a room when you came in. And that's just not, obviously, I'm going to say that. He was my husband, but other people would say the same thing about him. And then to have this, I mean, often people are like, oh, sure, there might have been other people I would think this might happen to, but not Sean. I was like, well, I don't have an answer to that. But yes, as far as seeing any signs, I that's the scary part about it is there just aren't any.
You do talk about in your book that you recognize also that childhood trauma was likely a contributing factor. Do you want to share a little bit about that?
Sure. I think in general, we all have events that negatively impact us. But what I think is the big difference is how we learn how to cope with what life hands us. And I'll say for Sean and for what he went through, he did have quite a bit of childhood trauma, and it was continuous. So it was, over a series of years, he experienced these negative events. But he also wasn't necessarily taught the healthiest way to cope with that. He wasn't necessarily taught that he knew all about tools. This is what I say. He knew that there were therapists. He knew that he could exercise. He knew that eating impacted. But at some point, he internalized and started to believe, and I say this at a cellular level. I believe the cellular piece of health is huge. And at some point, he fully believed that none of that would work for him because he was broken. And excuse me. And so when I look at that now, I think the change with the healthy coping skills and being able to manage or know that therapy can work for you. Maybe you need to find a different therapist. Exercise can work for you. But for me, I say, like, I went up against years of this, and it's hard when it's so deep into your cells that you truly believe that the experiences you had, that you created them, you're responsible for them, you deserved them, when in reality, that's not the case at all.
Yeah, that's so huge what you're talking about. And I think that is something that as we are healing from developmental trauma and repetitive type of trauma that you're talking about, we do take on those beliefs that these things happen to me because something is wrong with me. And we don't realize that that's likely a very early belief that we took on, and we're still believing it. And yeah, it influences everything. And the idea that you're broken, yeah, there's just so much there. So my heart just goes out to him and his suffering, and to you and your suffering and your son. and his family and your family. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you.
So you talked also about tips that, you know, you feel like there's some tips or strategies. Maybe we'll start with strategies that have been helpful for you in your healing journey, things that you found have helped you to begin to heal.
Absolutely. And I'll say any tool that I've used, it can change on a daily basis. So something might work one day, and then the next day I was going, there's no way I'm doing this. So I tried to combat this from as many angles as I could, honestly, because I knew I had my son that I had to take care of. And I do encourage people, if you're going through this, to find something that you can latch on to, so that when you're experiencing one of those horrible days where you don't want to get out of bed, you haven't slept, your anxiety is really high, you don't want to eat, but at least there's something that maybe gets you to the shower, maybe gets you to try nibbling something. And for me, that was my son, because I knew I didn't want his life. Our lives have been impacted by this, but I didn't want our lives to be dictated by it. So I had multiple therapists. I had a grief therapist. I actually still work with a grief therapist. I had a therapist who helped me with tapping and really getting to those cellular pieces, those limiting core beliefs that I had. I exercised. I journaled. I journal a lot. I meditated. I read books. I was soaking up every book I could at the time on understanding death, what people were talking about with quantum physics. I mean, I was going down all sorts of rabbit holes. And so I used anything and everything. I screamed, I cried, I would go to the gym and punch a bag, anything that I could to work through the feelings I had versus trying to bypass them. That's something I say, it's really important. They're not enjoyable feelings, but we have to work through them. And the release that we get, I've known people who haven't worked through them, and you can see how it impacts their life. And so I'm very big on encouraging people, try different things. And if something's not working for you, you don't have to continue. But those were big things where I was every day trying something different just to see if I could work through. And again, not speed up. I wish we could speed up the grief process, but you can't do that either, but at least to have opportunities to work through things. And I'll say one of the biggest things I had to do was actually look inward. A lot of my own core limiting beliefs were triggered throughout this process. And so, for instance, I was a major people pleaser. And so my people pleaser was just like having a party throughout this whole grief journey. And I had to really look inward and understand, what messages and projections did I get as a child that created and encouraged the people pleaser in me? And once I could start setting boundaries and really work through that and heal myself, it made it a little easier for me to be more grounded in how I was feeling after my husband died and really take on these feelings instead of trying to, I myself tried to bypass them. I was like, I don't need to do this. But again, it just perpetuates feeling awful versus really riding that wave and getting to the other side.
Oh, those were so helpful, what you were saying. Yeah. I wanted to write down and I missed it, but you said something about you wanted to identify you and your son, that it did impact you, but it didn't. Could you finish that?
Sure. Yeah. That it didn't have to dictate our life.
Yes. 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 So you're acknowledging that it impacted, but that it wasn't going to revolve everything around that. Yeah.
Absolutely. And a big changing point for me in my grief process was when I got to the point that I realized my son had been alive longer without his dad than with his dad. Even saying that still gets me, like, I'm like teary eyed now talking about it. But that was a big turning point for me. And I realized that there were certain things and some of those emotions that I was still holding on to, and that it wasn't serving my son and serving me as a mom, because that kind of energy was seeping and available to my son. And I thought that's not fair to him because he's not necessarily going to remember his dad. We have pictures up. He knows who his dad is. If he sees a picture, he knows. But he's not necessarily going to have memories. And I didn't want his life to just have this cloud of, oh, you're the kid whose dad died by suicide, versus you're a kid. Your family looks different. You got mom and you, and your dad did die, and he's still with you. But that it does, you know, and you see it just a little different way in approaching. Does that make sense? It's kind of a how to approach what our family looks like now versus just having it be kind of at the forefront constantly.
Yeah, it does make sense. Wow. I'm so touched by the love that you have and the empathy for your son, because I think sometimes we can get so caught up in ourselves and our pain, but I love that you are, I mean, you're recognizing that you have pain and you have a son that has a life, and you know, you want to help him and you're helping to shape his life. And I just think that's just so incredible and so beautiful. And yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. So, you know, maybe you can talk to us about what things have been helpful for you. So you talked about like the exercise and therapy and reading, but are there any things that, you know, we were talking, I think, at the beginning about the planning piece that we don't, or the talking about should something happen. Is there anything that you want to share that can help people think about stuff?
Yeah, I think sometimes we don't want to think about things we consider negative as though we're going to bring those on. And talking about death isn't, I mean, I can't predict this. So you guys don't hold me to this, but I don't think talking about death means you're going to bring it on. I like to encourage people to do certain things in planning or thinking about things when you feel good and healthy. So for instance, even if separate from kind of the practical things, if you've had traumatic events and you know that you're, you know, still working through those, when you're on a good day, right? We tend to wait until we're not feeling well to go seek out the therapist, to start exercising, to change our diet. And I myself still try to encourage myself and others to, you know, really put things into place when you're feeling good, so that when you have those moments where you're a little off, those habits are still formed, already formed, and you just keep going. In regards to some of the other practical things, I'm all for people having wills. Put it down. I mean, there's so much in my situation. My husband did not have a will, and I think that caused a lot of the complications with my particular situation. But have it in writing, have it somewhere, so that, you know, people can still try and contest and do all of those things, which are awful, but have that, you know, talk about what would you like if something medically happens to you. If you have children, where would you like your children to go? If you need to talk to an accountant or get some financial affairs or get some life insurance, like, do it when you feel good. I mean, it's annoying. Don't get me wrong. It's very annoying. It's bureaucratic. There's paperwork. There's things you have to do. But it'll make things so much easier, because when someone dies, it's very emotional. I don't understand why we have to go through all that we do and looking at estates and reading wills and doing all that as early as we do after someone passes, because we're still in a heightened emotional state. And depending on how someone died, you can still be in shock, and then you're making decisions, but your body is still trying to protect you. So I highly suggest and encourage people to think about those things and have them in place, and just let your loved ones know this is where you can find that information, so that there are no questions. It's all figured out, and it kind of takes the pressure off of making those decisions, especially when you're in that emotional state.
That is such good advice, really. And I think that younger couples or younger families may not think about that. So it's good to think about it on a day that you're feeling good or okay. Yeah, that's really good. All right. Well, I'm just thinking if there is anything else that maybe that you want to share before we close that you think is important.
Yeah. I mean, first, I just so appreciate having the time with you and Really, I think if we can shift and understand that someone who gets to this point, their death is, while the manner of their death is different, their pain is no different than someone else who is dealing with disease. And it's just not tangible, it's not visible, and we don't necessarily have the clues that someone is hurting. And I think when we can shift that mindset, we really can approach people who die this way with more love and compassion. And I think that's really what my goal is, to try and help us all shift that mindset, to understand that these people didn't do this to us. They didn't die to hurt us. They died because they thought that they were a burden and that this was a way to end their pain. And I think when we can take ourselves out of the equation, we can have more of that love and compassion for these individuals.
Did it take you time to come to that place?
Oh,
or did
absolutely.
You feel that?
I mean, I knew, I will say that the day that he died, someone said, how could he come to this decision? And I knew the pain he was in. I just didn't know that this was going to be his out. But it took a long time for me even to separate myself, because for a long time I had my own questions around it. But once I was able to separate myself from him and understand what he was really going through, then I was like, oh, okay, no, you need some more love and compassion.
And this just came to me too, about support groups. So did you find support groups for people in your situation helpful?
Yes, absolutely. So locally here in Colorado, we have what's called a heartbeat, our heartbeat support groups. I know that nationwide there are suicide support groups. And absolutely, because just I think loss support groups can be really great. And I was actually invited to a grief group initially, and I declined at the time because I needed to be around people who had the same shock and loss that I did, in order to create that comfort. It's an unspoken understanding when you walk in and you just know that people had the same loss. You don't have to explain yourself. They're not asking questions. They're not wanting to know, how did it come to this? They just understood. I'm a very big proponent of seeking out support groups from any loss that you have, to have that, just so that you can have that camaraderie, because grief can feel very isolating and very lonely. And having a support group or people to reach out to is very important.
That's great. Thank you so much. All right, Alexandra. So I'm going to put your book in the show notes. It was a really, really good book. Got me thinking as well. And I thank you so much for coming on here and sharing your story. I really do.
Thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure speaking with you today.